The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsman Ziegler presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Before we start up this morning, I'd like to just take a moment of silence in honor of the 22nd anniversary of 9/11. All right, thank you. Calling our first case, 22AP 1334 AMB versus Circuit Court for Ashland County. Could I please have your appearances?
To marry. My second point, the state of Wisconsin has no authority under the U.S. or Wisconsin constitutions to punish a child because her mother does not want to get married. First, I'm going to turn to the father. I'm going to call him a father today, even though the state doesn't legally recognize him as that. He has raised this child for over a decade as his own. The United States Supreme Court expressed in no uncertain terms that decisions involving marriage are one of the most private decisions an individual can make and are not to be infringed by the government. Quote, choices about marriage shape an individual's destiny. The decision whether and whom to marry is among life's momentous acts of self-definition and are the most intimate decision a person can make.
This counsel, unlike in Obergefell, the state isn't doing anything to prevent these two people from getting married.
If you take away enough of these rights, you essentially are compelling people to get married. This is the right to adopt a child. Adoption goes to the core of who we are. To raise children who are not biologically related to us as our own. This is such a particularly important right. And if you take this away, based on what the state argues rational basis, can you take away the right to drive a certain vehicle because someone's not married? Can you take away the right to operate a certain business because the state very rationally has found that maybe certain businesses are more productive, they drive more revenue, they're more stable if they're run by married people. If you take away enough of these rights, they're not telling them they have to get married, but they're essentially saying to participate in a democracy or to participate in our country, you have different privileges if you're married versus unmarried, and you are infringing on that right.
You're asking us, though, to recognize as, I think, a fundamental right, the right to adopt, but there isn't a court in the country, the United States Supreme Court, no federal court, no one has recognized adoption as a fundamental right. You concede that, right?
I'm not asking you to recognize the adoption as a fundamental right. The problem here is as a statutory subdivision under adoption is you are infringing on someone's right to marry. So adoption has never been recognized as a fundamental right. But if you had a suspect class under there, if you said people of a certain ethnicity wouldn't be able to adopt, if you said people of a certain national origin wouldn't be able to adopt, I mean, would that be okay just because adoption is not a fundamental right?
But being unmarried is not a suspect classification in the same way that race or ethnicity is, correct?
The United States Supreme Court has found it to be a fundamental right.
That's a different question than whether being unmarried is a suspect classification. You do it has never been recognized as a suspect classification.
Being unmarried is not a suspect right, but it is the fundamental right of to remain unmarried that is to be held to the highest scrutiny.
I think the bottom line here might be what level of scrutiny are you asking that we apply here?
With respect to someone's right to marry, I would ask for strict scrutiny. To infringe upon someone's right to marry, anything that says if you're not married, the state of Wisconsin cannot divide people into two buckets. You're married and you're not married.
Okay, but don't we do that with other statutes? My concern with your whole argument is you're saying you can't treat married people different than unmarried, but we do it all the time. We do it with respect to taxes and other types of benefits. So according to your analysis, if we go down that road that you really can't treat people differently, we've got an entire tax system that goes out the window.
But we don't tell people that they don't have to pay taxes if they're not if they're married and only married people.
The taxes
we tell people that you can pay these taxes if you're married and these taxes if you're not. And you get a benefit, supposedly, if you're married. So we are telling people, and according to your logic, we are telling people to get married if they want the benefit, which isn't that a similar
Here's the difference. The difference is courts have found all along that economic rights and economic differences, what most of the differences are here, are not at the same level as other rights. There are certain particularly important rights that are more important than, quote, a mere loss of economic money, a mere loss of money. I have to know that the one case that the state noted in their brief, the Califano brief, if you look at that case, the difference in money was $20 a month. And to compare, saying, well, you could, when the person got married, their one benefit went away. And all of their other federal benefits, there is a note in that case that the difference that person that made a difference in that person's life was they lost $20 a month. And to compare losing $20 a month to the same as not being able to adopt a child that you have raised your whole life, it's comparing apples and oranges.
Well, I hear you on that, but the analysis you're asking us to adopt, if we go down the path you're saying, is that any statute that gives a benefit or a priority to someone who's married violates the law because of your right to marry or not marry. That, I mean, looking at what actually we're talking about, money versus children, obviously adopting a child is a whole different matter, but that your analysis that you're having us go down is that same analysis, and I just don't see where that ends.
Ms. Smith, what happens to your argument if you cannot convince a majority of this court to apply strict scrutiny? What happens to your argument if we think, this is a rational basis type of case?
I think it's a problem. I think if you defer to the legislature on rational basis, adoption isn't the only right that they could take away. They could have a rational basis to take away a whole bucket of many rights. And that
But you have to look at the source of the rights or what protects certain rights. And if we don't accept your argument that there's a 14th Amendment equal protection right to adopt, which, again, no court has ever recognized to date, if we don't accept that, then we are looking at whether the legislature has a rational basis for making the statutory distinctions that it has chosen to do. Because we might, as people, agree with you that adoption should be freely available, particularly when it's in the best interest of the child, which it clearly is in this case based on the circuit court's findings. But the legislature has enacted a statutory scheme of when adoption is permissible and when it isn't permissible. So the only question for this court is not whether as human beings we agree that this man should be able to adopt this child. It's whether or not we have the power to override the policy decisions that the legislature has made. And just to let you know, I don't see it in your argument that we have that power.
So, again, I think most of the arguments made by the state have been purely economic in nature, and I do think that there are compelling reasons for that different treatment.
I just want to ask you about your strict scrutiny argument. Why do you think this is a strict scrutiny case?
Because it goes down to the most private individual decision you can make. It goes back to the United States Supreme Court saying that the decision of whether to marry is one of life's most intimate decisions, central to human dignity, inherent in the liberty of the person, central to autonomy, defining personal identity and beliefs. We cannot be a state that just decides that we are going to take, okay, adoption isn't a fundamental right, but it's an extremely important right. And our case law shows on a host of things that there are particularly important rights that should be held to a little bit of a higher standard than just deferring to the legislator. And this language, you cannot read Obergefell versus Hodges and not think, you know, this is not anywhere the state should be of depriving someone from a position to not being able to adopt a child based solely on their decision to remain married.
Counsel, I want to actually talk about Obergefell. I found your citation there a little perplexing, actually, because in that opinion, the court, in Justice Kennedy's majority opinion, gives four reasons why he argued that that marriage ought to be extended to same-sex couples. Issues three and four hinge entirely upon the unique status of marriage in the law. The third basis that he writes is that it safeguards children and families. Marriage affords permanence and stability important to children's best interests. Without the stability that marriage offers, children suffer. The significant material costs of being raised by unmarried parents relegates them to a difficult and more uncertain family life. And the fourth reason, marriage is the, quote, keystone of our social order. And just as a couple vows to support each other, so does society pledge to support the couple, offering symbolic recognition and material benefits to protect and nourish the union. And indeed, while states are in general free to vary the benefits they confer on all married couples, they have throughout our history made marriage the basis for an expanding list of governmental rights, benefits, and responsibilities. Among those he lists is adoption rights. And he says marriage is at the center of our legal and social order, in that the state again continues to link a constellation of benefits to marriage. The heart of your argument seems to be that the state cannot rationally prefer marriage to non-marriage when it confers the right to adoption. And I don't, number one, that seems to me to be a really dramatic claim, number one. And number two, that actually runs entirely contrary to Obergefell, upon which you rely significantly, because Obergefell explicitly says the reason we're going to extend marriage is because marriage is preferred in the law, can be preferred in the law, and it is so important. And you're saying marriage is not important, and we should hold so as a matter of equal protection.
That's not exactly what I'm saying. I think marriage is an incredibly important institution, and I've read that exactly what you quoted in over. It is what they said, a foundation of a lot of things in our society, but does it equal stability? Can you say, and part of the state's argument is that stability, which is one factor in marriage, equals it. And I don't think
it doesn't have to under the test, though, right? If we're applying rational basis, I understand you're advocating for strict scrutiny, but let's put that aside for just a moment. If you're advocating for rational basis, the question is not whether the line drawing here is good or bad, whether the line drawing as applied to your particular clients is good or bad. It's not whether another legislature could reasonably or even with good reason make other policy choices. The question is whether the legislature can reasonably make this policy choice that prefers marriage to non-marriage. And I'm not hearing you address the actual legal test that we need to apply.
I don't think that the legislature can rationally take away someone's right to adopt. And I'm not even sure if that was their intent, because if you look at 48.82, unmarried people can adopt in Wisconsin. And there is no hierarchy of married people versus unmarried people adopting. And they are at the same level, except when it comes to if there is one parent who is alive. It makes zero sense that you can adopt as an unmarried person under 48.82, but if you want to adopt the child you've raised your entire life, under 48.81, if that child has one legal parent, you cannot adopt that child.
And I just want to two follow-up questions. One is, are you making a statutory argument, or is your argument purely constitutional? There's a section of your briefing that talks about the best interests of the child and those sorts of things. It seems to me, though, that other parts of your brief say it's just a constitutional question. I wasn't quite clear.
There is a statutory argument because there is no rhyme or reason with the statute. It does not make sense. If you were to say, well, marriage is, you know, predicts stability and we should have everybody get married and that's fine to do an adoption, Wisconsin allows unmarried people to adopt.
That's a constitutional argument, I think. I'm asking, are you saying that the statute permits your clients to adopt in this case in any way?
No.
Okay. Some of your arguments talk about the best interests of the child, perhaps overriding, maybe echoing the dissent in Angel Lace. But the legislature obviously subsequently amended that, seemed to confirm that. I don't see you making a separate statutory argument.
That's correct.
Okay. So you're focused. And then the second, just one other follow-up, and then obviously let my colleagues ask some questions. And that is, are you making a facial challenge? Or are you arguing that the statute as applied to your client? I read you as making more of a facial challenge.
It would be more of a hybrid challenge that the state said in their brief is it's both facial and as applied to my clients. I don't think it's constitutional for anybody out there to deprive them of the right to adoption based solely on their own private decision not to get married.
I think that would be a facial challenge then,
yes.
Right? A facial challenge in your argument seems to be that the state can't make this policy decision, that it's irrational. That would apply no matter who it applies to. So it's not so much your client's specific fact scenarios, even if it's sympathetic under the circumstances. You're saying this can't rationally apply to anyone here.
That's correct.
Okay.
Counsel, I interpreted your challenge to be more of an as-applied challenge as opposed to a facial challenge. Is there any circumstance in which this statute can be applied constitutionally, in your view?
That's a good question.
Well, that's the facial challenge inquiry.
Yeah, and I just don't think so. I don't think that you can put someone in a bucket and say, regardless of the stability of this particular family, regardless of the S has done an extensive review, regardless that this is the best interest of the child to have two legal parents. I don't think that it could, that the statute stands.
Can you cite to any case that supports the premise that there is either a right to be adopted or a right to adopt?
It's a relatively recent statutory development. And so my part of the precedent that I think I have to distinguish with the precedent. So the precedent case talks of, hey, we're not, you know, covering marriage, we're only covering adoption. I think it's really important that this court look at how the right to marry is being put as a subsection of the right to adoption.
We don't want a hodgepodge statute. I call a hodgepodge statute Swiss cheese, you know, all sorts of holes to it. And in preparing for this case and having in mind the next case that we will be hearing after this, which deals with the Catholic Charities Bureau, I thought of this question. In the Catholic religion, a major tenet is that, or a tenet, is that if you're divorced, you can't remarry. If your client made an argument that he is precluded from marrying by the free exercise of his religion, right? How would that change at all? In other words, what's going through my mind is, oh, that sounds like strict scrutiny to me. I might be wrong because I haven't researched that, but it sounds like strict scrutiny. And if it is, then why can't pleadings just be amended for anyone to aver my religion precludes me from remarrying, therefore applied to me, this is unconstitutional and it impinges my free exercise of religion. So deal with that.
You hinged on our conversation with his family last night because this is precisely the question that came up, as was there a religious reason? And you're right. For some reason, the court would treat it differently because there is a religious reason not to marry, and that invokes a different standard. So, that's precisely what we were talking about in our hotel last night. But it just doesn't, unfortunately, they wanted to be as, forthcoming and truthful and honest as possible. I realize I only have 5 minutes, and the second point is the child, is you cannot punish a child for the marital decision of the mother. There is U.S. Supreme Court case almost identically on point on this. It is Trimble v. Gordon. They tried to take away intestate inheritance rights from a child based on the fact that the mother had not married the father. And they had held that it was intermediate scrutiny. Is this child has absolutely nothing to do with a decision of whether to marry or not. So making her completely ineligible to be adopted by a second parent is the ends do not justify the means. You cannot, exactly as Trimble said, it pretty much, is... It completely goes against our basic notions that individual consequences have to do with our own actions. This child has absolutely nothing to do with her mother's decision not to marry. Trimble v. Gordon said that specifically, is that you cannot pin the consequences on an infant, on the head of an infant, for a decision she has nothing to do with. So they did intermediate scrutiny in that case. And I think even if the court doesn't find the marriage argument compelling, I don't think we can be in a situation where we are treating differently, children based on the marital decision of their parents. And so that's my argument with respect to the child, is that I think there's very clear case law. Would we be able to do this that she can't get a license? Would we be able to do this on any other right? This is different than Angel v. Lace. This is different because Angel v. Lace preserved the relationship with two parents. One of those parents, ironically, was a non-biological and a divorced parent. We're not preserving this child's relationship with two parents. She only has one. She only has one parent. And to say you're not ever going to have a second parent until your mother decides to marry is not constitutional. It's identical to what the court in Trimble said, and that you cannot make consequences for actions when you have absolutely nothing to do with it.
Angel Lace did with regard to the child's equal protection claim. I think that was raised and was answered in there. I think that the claim of the other parent here is, or in-home parent is not is different. But it seems that that issue was explicitly addressed by us then, correct?
I do want to make a point of I don't think there's one other Wisconsin law out there where the government wants two other living people to do something and they punish a third person for it. And I think it's inherently unconstitutional to do that. It does not tie actions to anything that she does.
Your argument would require overruling Angel Ace on that particular claim for the child.
Yes, it would. And just a few seconds, just this family is, like, as I said, adopting children who are not your own to go to the core of who we are and all the goodness. And you had over a decade ago, a single mother with a baby, and a gentleman came in and he stood up, and he stood up big time, and he raised her, and he provided financial and educational and every support possible. And for him to be penalized for that and not allowing him to adopt this child, that to me is unheard of.
Before your time is up, let me ask a quick question to springboard off of what you just said. One of the arguments on the other side is that were this couple married and were they then to get divorced, there would be all these laws that would kick in as far as child support is concerned and as far as custody is concerned. And if I understand the brief on the other side, they say, look, that safety net, and I have a lot of questions about how safe that net actually is, but I'll save that for the moment, that would not be in place in this situation. And I read your brief to say something a little bit different, but I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that argument on the other side.
The way you financially provide for this child is to provide legal rights to her father and the only father she has ever known. That is the way you bridge the income difference, through child support, should something happen to this relationship. You don't, there are so many, I know the state brought that up, there's so many caveats to when you get divorced and whether they're equal or unequal assets at that moment of time, but the way you bridge the financial difference is to recognize him as a father, and then you can do the child support based on the difference in income.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The dispositive question in this case is whether the legislature had any conceivable, rational basis for limiting the adoption of a child with one legal parent to the spouse of that child's parent. That standard is easily met here, given the rational connection between marriage and stability for adopted children. The Court can agree or disagree with the underlying policy choice, but as this Court has already held in Angel Ace, there is a rational basis underlying these statutes, and that is enough to sustain them as constitutional. We've talked a lot about Obergefell this morning, so to begin, I want to briefly start there and explain how Obergefell unquestionably does not raise the level of scrutiny in this case.
Before you do that, I want to ask you a few questions about this notion of stability. And I think you start talking about it around page 28 of your brief, or at least that's where you start to flesh it out. And I guess my question to you is, I'm struggling with how rational this is. And I'm really struggling with this idea that married homes are more stable than unmarried homes. And I'll just disclose right now that I am a single mom of two kids. So I'm really wondering what you mean about more stable.
Okay. So it's true that both married couples and unmarried couples can provide stable homes for children, but it doesn't mean that it is irrational for the legislature to distinguish between spouses and other third parties when it comes to step-parent adoption, because there are benefits to children that are specific to marriage, benefits that get to this point of stability, which is the legislature's goal when it comes to adopted children. So, number one, married couples with children are more likely to remain together than unmarried couples with children. This is largely...
But we don't even have to get into the divorce rate, right? Was it 40%, 42%, right? And what about all of the women in this state who choose not to have a partner, who choose just to have a baby on their own?
So the divorce rate, it is what it is, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't negate the largely uncontested fact that married couples with children are more likely to remain together than unmarried couples with children.
Let me push back on that with my 25 years of domestic violence work. I have seen so many women trapped in marriages where there is violence and there is abuse, and there is no way anyone could possibly say that those kids are in a better position than they would be were they free of the violence and abuse in that marriage.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I mean, that's true, but the question here is not whether this statute can guarantee the best result in every circumstance. Under rational basis review, it doesn't have to do that. The only question is whether the classification the legislature has made here has any conceivable rational basis. So I talked about the statistical likelihood of married couples remaining together as opposed to unmarried couples, but also the state connects a whole constellation of benefits to marriage, benefits that help protect and nourish that family unit with an eye towards stability, benefits the couple, but also the children involved. There are many in Wisconsin, but to name a few, they include the enforceable duty of support between spouses, shared property rights, hospital access, and medical decision-making authority. And if the spouses were to divorce, the entitlement to an equitable division of assets. There are no such protections in place for unmarried couples. So here we have rational reasons why the legislature may prefer marriage.
So rational reasons are there's a bit of an irony here, right? I mean, you're saying that it's rational, but it's only rational because then the legislature has put all these other, has helped married couples in all these other ways where they haven't helped, as I well know, single moms.
Mm-hmm. I guess I don't understand your question.
So you're telling me that the reason this is rational is because the legislature allows all these other... It's just a bit ironic that the legislature on the one hand is saying we're so rational here and we're saying that you're way better off if you're the product of a married couple. And the way we're going to prove that is because married couples get all these benefits that we're going to throw on top of what they already have, what we're saying they already have, that we're not going to give unmarried and single moms.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me come at this a different way. So when it comes to distinguishing between spouses and other third parties in the context of step-parent adoption, we've talked about how there are conceivable benefits that are specific to marriage. You may agree or disagree. But also, this category of children are children that already have a legal parent. So unlike children that have no parents, these are children who are already part of a permanent family unit. And so there's a different interest involved here where the state wants to avoid the destabilization of that family unit that would be caused if a third party comes in and adopts that child and then separates from the other parent.
So let me ask you a question about this, because this is the way I see your hierarchy, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, but I see you saying that the platinum standard, as we sometimes use, is for a child to grow up in a home with a married couple. Yes? And then the next standard, say we'll call it the gold standard, second best, is when a child grows up in a single parent home. And coming in last is when a child grows up in a home where there are two unmarried people. Why? Because that might get them to the second best, which is where you only have one adult in the home. That logic doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't see that hierarchy, Your Honor. So I think that you're referring to the fact that a married couple can jointly adopt. An unmarried person can individually adopt a child, But when it comes to step-parent adoption, only the spouse of that child's parent can adopt the child. We're talking about who has the ability to formalize their relationship through adoption. And an unmarried individual who adopts a child without parents, nothing prevents them from choosing to structure their household in a way where a committed partner resides with them and assists with raising that child. And in this situation, nothing prevents the petitioners here from continuing their household arrangement, which appears to be providing a safe and happy home for this child.
Okay, so counsel, one of the arguments that the state makes is that you wish to promote stability, right? Would this child's life not be more stable if TG were allowed to adopt her? And rather than having this complete and total ban, wouldn't it be better to be able to look at this on a case-by-case basis?
Well, I don't know that we can assume that this child's life would be more stabilized if TG were permitted to adopt her. I think as a practical matter, her day-to-day life is likely going to remain the same regardless of the outcome in this case. And the
I think she might beg to differ with that, and certainly all the experts that testified in the court down below would not agree with that. I mean, they all agree that it was in the best interest of this child were the adoption to happen.
To push back briefly on that, and just to clarify, there was no formal fact-finding in the trial court. This was not a case where the judge collected testimony and made formal findings of fact, because the judge had already decided when the parties came before him that he was not authorized to grant that adoption. And he did say on the record that, at least based on the home study report that was filed, the adoption appeared to be in the child's best interest, but he still had no authority to grant it. So the petitioners did file a home study report from a social worker at DHS. That report was never authenticated, there were no experts testifying. That social worker never testified. And
was the report received in evidence?
No, there was no evidentiary hearing. So the only factual finding truly that we have to work with is just the court's informal statement on the record that he thought that adoption would be in the child's best interest.
Counsel, this is a facial challenge, and of course I mean nothing, no disrespect in the current situation, but none of that matters in a facial challenge. In a facial challenge, what matters is the law, not the specific circumstances of the situation, right?
That's correct. And I thought it was important to clarify, based on Justice Protasiewicz's question about whether we should be looking at the specific facts of this case. And I, coming back to that question, Your Honor, the legislature could have structured the adoption statutes to allow trial court judges to have broad discretion to adopt or to authorize adoptions whenever that judge felt that it was in the child's best interest. But that's not how the legislature structured these statutes. The legislature has decided that there are certain eligibility and procedural requirements that must be met first, requirements that in their view are in the best interest of the child. And then once all of those statutory requirements are met, that's when the best interest finding comes into play.
Counsel, is there any legal authority anywhere that would allow this court to override the policy determinations made by the legislature on a case-by-case basis?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Take my prior hypothetical with the addition of course, Catholics are allowed to remarry if there's an annulment. But what would preclude folks in the future, from you in the future, advising your clients to aver that their religion precludes them from remarrying, and then challenging the statute as unconstitutional, abridging the First Amendment free exercise? What would preclude that?
I don't think that situation would pose an infringement on a constitutional right. And here's why. The statute says who is eligible to adopt and who is not eligible to adopt. And adoption is not a fundamental right.
But exercising your religion is, right?
Sure. And that person has the freedom to exercise their religion and choose not to marry because their religion tells them that that's what they should do. But it doesn't mean that they have a right to an affirmative action by the state to grant them this adoption, even though they have this, religious directive, I guess. And in a way, it's the same situation that we had in Angel Lace. Those petitioners were legally prohibited from marrying because of the prohibition on same-sex marriage that was in effect at that time. Those adoption statutes, these same adoption statutes that we're looking today, were still subject to rational basis review. And I think it would be the same even if there wasn't a prohibition on marriage, but rather a religious reason why a person felt they could not marry.
And that all hinges on the fact that there's no right to adopt.
That's correct.
And counsel, if we agree with your arguments today, that doesn't prohibit a future person in circumstances who has other constitutional rights they'd like to assert from making such a claim, right? When we're dealing with a facial equal protection claim, that doesn't say anything about other constitutional rights that could be claimed and by a future person, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Could you address the Trimble argument that was raised, I think, in the reply brief for the first time and was raised again today? I want to give you an opportunity to speak to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Trimble v. Gordon and the principle provided by the petitioners from that case is not applicable here for two reasons. First, Trimble v. Gordon is one of a line of cases that dealt with laws discriminating against illegitimate children, meaning children that were born out of wedlock. The court found this to be a historically disadvantaged class, such that heightened scrutiny was appropriate. The statutes that we have here do not discriminate on that basis. For example, we don't know whether the child involved in this case was born to a married couple or not. All that matters is whether she currently has one legal parent or no legal parents. The second reason why that principle is not applicable is because the law that was being challenged in Trimble v. Gordon was unquestionably a sanction on illegitimate children. It said that...
I think we really should use the term children born out of wedlock. I think
no child is illegitimate.
No child is illegitimate.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Thank you.
Thank you for the correction. So
you're using the wording that was used in that case, which is from the 1970s.
I think we still should be very careful in this room with the words that we use, and I think to the extent that you're able to use children out of wedlock, that would be great. Thank you.
I agree with you. Thank you, Your Honor. So
you were saying the law in question was?
The law in question sanctioned children born out of wedlock by prohibiting them from being able to inherit from their fathers through in-estate succession. The laws that we're talking about here are laws that the legislature has enacted because it views them as in the child's best interest. And we know that because of the stated legislative intent in the preface to Chapter 48. The legislature says that its goal in these adoption statutes and the other statutes throughout Chapter 48 is to protect children and promote their best interests. And they've made a judgment that in the case of children with one legal parent, it's in their best interest. It's on balance the best policy to limit the adoption of that child to the spouse of the existing parent.
When looking at the rational basis test, do you look at that, does it survive if all people agree there's a rational basis, or is the test something other than that? If some people think it's not a good policy decision, does it fail the rational basis test?
No, Your Honor. There can be disagreement about what is best here, and spirited disagreement about where the correct place is to draw that line when it comes to step-parent adoption. But the relevant question from a constitutional standpoint is whether there's any conceivable rational basis for the legislation. The way rational basis review works is that the courts defer to the legislature on those really difficult questions of policy. You can disagree, but as long as you can see the conceivable rational connection, that's enough to sustain the statute as constitutional.
You take this as a facial challenge also rather than an as-applied challenge?
I do.
I mean, by the test that you just announced, any conceivable is akin to the facial challenge test rather than as applied to this individual, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And if you use the as applied test rather than, if you saw this as an as applied test rather than a facial test, how, if at all, would your argument differ?
My argument wouldn't change very much because I still think that there are rational reasons for the legislature to prefer marriage in this context, and for all the reasons that I've already discussed. So understanding that in this as-applied situation, the trial court judge said that the adoption would be in the child's best interest, that's not enough to make it unconstitutional. It doesn't mean that it's not rational for the legislature to want to limit adoption of children with one legal parent to spouses. It has to do with the likelihood that married couples are going to remain together as opposed to unmarried couples with children, the benefits that come along with marriage that protect that family unit and also the children involved, and their added interest in not destabilizing that family unit that already exists, which is different when you, as compared to situations where a child has no parents.
One of the arguments that resonated with me, you speak of the benefits of marriage, and yet it's your position to preclude adoption unless married. Here, a benefit seems to me to the child to allow adoption regardless of marriage for economic reasons. That is, if the partners split, you know, if they're separated, there's no child support that can be ordered for the child. The laws of intestacy do not apply to this child. So it seems as though your argument, although you speak of benefits, really is potentially disadvantageous to the child.
Your Honor is correct that there are reasons why the legislature may want to allow more people to come in and step parent adopt. And you've identified some of those reasons. You're right. This child would not be eligible for child support, for example, from petitioner TG unless he had adopted her. But this goes back to weighing the pros and cons because there are reasons why the result may seem harsh in this case, but there are also reasons why, or situations where the law works as intended, and you can see why it was good to limit the adoption of that child to a spouse in the interests of stabilization for that child.
And in an as-applied challenge, the harshness versus the benefit, is that examined?
I think that so long as there are benefits, even in an as-applied challenge, that's enough to sustain the statute as constitutional. Even if this court were to feel that in this situation the disadvantages outweigh the benefits, that's still a quintessential legislative question. So stepping back for a moment, the petitioners have conceded that we have a dispositive precedent here in Angel Lace, and that this court would first need to overturn that case before it could rule in their favor. The court should not do so because the constitutional questions in Angel Lace were correctly decided, and the justifications that have been suggested by the petitioners for overturning that precedent are plainly inadequate. To start, they have not argued that Angel Lace was wrongly decided when the decision was issued. Instead, they have argued that the advent of marriage equality through Obergefell and other advancements for same-sex couples somehow undermine the relevant constitutional holdings. But that is simply not the case. First, the equal protection analysis in Angel Lace in no way turned on the fact that the case involved a same-sex couple. It turned on the fact that it involved an unmarried couple. And the decision was not based in any part on the premise that same-sex couples should be treated differently than opposite-sex couples. But also, Obergefell cannot be read to undercut the court's reasoning in Angel Lace, because, as Justice Hagedorn pointed out, the entire decision affirms the value and importance of marriage not just to individuals, but also to the state. And really, if Obergefell has any relevance to Angel Lace, it's that it eliminates the barrier to adoption that was present then because of the prohibition on same-sex marriages. The petitioners in Angel Lace had no ability to marry, and therefore they had no ability to utilize the step-parent adoption process that the statutes provide for. There is no such barrier present here, and that makes this particular constitutional challenge significantly less compelling than what the court already considered in Angel Lace. So, in short, they have not identified anything in Obergefell or any other advancements in the law that undermine the relevant holdings of Angel Lace. The only other justification that they've suggested for overturning that precedent is their contention that social views on marriage have changed such that more people now view marriage as less important when it comes to raising children. But even if that was true, it doesn't undermine the state's interest in marriage or its view of marriage as a stabilizing influence on families. And it wouldn't be a reason to invalidate the statutes as constitutional. It would be a reason to refer them back to the legislature for a fresh look. In closing, and unless the court has any additional questions, we are asking this court to leave its precedent in Angel Lace undisturbed, uphold the step-parent adoption statutes as constitutional, and affirm the decision of the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Good morning. The state raises a few issues that we addressed in our reply motion or our reply brief, but I just want to hit on here head on. One of them is the rational basis. And if you look at the statute, it says that single people can adopt and they don't have to be married. So on one hand, we are saying you have to be married if the child still has one birth parent whose rights are still intact. But then if the child has no parents, you can be single.
So but isn't the rational basis for that the idea that it's better for a child to achieve permanency with a single parent than to have the impermanency of foster care or some other arrangement like that?
One's better than nothing, right? I understand that, but you cannot say that marriage is that important if we still allow single individuals to adopt. So, if we have a child here who has one parent at this point, which is a distinction that was not in place with Angel Lace. Angel Lace had two parents. We have a child who has one parent, and we're trying to give this child two parents. This is akin to, and this goes back to, what happens if the parents all of a sudden split? Well, we have that occur all the time. We have lots of single parents who give birth, and the state has the child support agencies get VPAs, voluntary paternity acknowledgments, and adjudicate fathers, and so that we have two parents on board who are not married. So we have that happen quite frequently. And what happens if they split? Well, Chapter 767 allows for there to be a petition to establish custody, placement, child support, etc. So just because you're not married doesn't mean that you also don't have all these other rights. We already have that in chapter 767. Looking at, again, at the rational basis, who's benefiting from this law? Is the state really benefiting by compelling these parties to be married? What's the benefit? Is the child benefiting to require that her parents be married?
But with rational basis review, we're not looking at the individual circumstances, right? We're looking for any conceivable state of facts that would make the legislature's choices rational. So while this doesn't apply to this family situation, we have an amicus brief that cites studies saying children living with a single parent who had a cohabiting partner in the household had the highest rate in all maltreatment categories. Isn't that sufficient that we can identify a rational basis for the legislature's chosen classifications, even if there are all kinds of exceptions? I mean, the argument seems to be something better addressed to the legislature to say, hey, legislature, this classification you've created is penalizing and harming children like this one, so why don't you change it and carve out different exceptions? But we don't have the power to do that, do we, counsel, under rational basis review?
I would love for the legislature to take this up. But our clients, we can't wait for, their rights can't be held in abeyance waiting for the legislature to act and to revisit this. With respect to those studies, I think you can look at them in different ways. Is it true that my client who wants to adopt is less likely to assault his daughter if he gets married to the child's mother? I don't think so.
And counsel, while you're getting your water, I mean, that's the whole point, right, of rational basis review and our deference to the legislature, because they're better situated to look at all of these studies and to make the policy decisions that they make, and then they are held accountable to the people for those policy decisions that are reflected in the laws they enact.
And did the legislature actually look at these type of studies, or was this a statute adopted at a time when maybe it was gay marriage that was pushing it? I don't know. We don't have the legislative history on this, but it certainly smells like it probably was. But I think you can look at the rational basis, not just to our situation, but in general. Who benefits from compelling the parents to be married? It gets back to, I call it the bucket of rights that the legislature has created for the married couples. You don't have that.
How about one sentence? Wrap sure. It up in one.
I appreciate all of your attention, and we look forward to a decision.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for interesting oral argument this morning. Court is adjourned. We will reconvene for the second oral argument.